This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati City Council has a new member, while two legal cases proceed against other council members. So we start the weekly news review now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So glad to have you back. And also glad to have back Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Hi, Chris. Glad you could take some time out of your Friday for us. And do we have Chris? I know he was having some technical issues earlier, but we'll come back to Chris as soon as we confirm that he's back on the line. No big deal if you need to reconnect. We do connect with our guests remotely these days due to the pandemic, and we are using Zoom for both Sherry and Chris. So we'll wait for Chris to join us. Sherry, I do want to start with, before we get into like the maneuvering of what's happening as to the makeup of the current members on Cincinnati City Council. I know that the city has been rocked by these scandals. Three council members arrested in this calendar year, including two in rapid succession just very recently, Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld. What are you hearing, if anything, or what should we brace ourselves for as it relates to the possibility of more coming down the pike?
Well, we don't know any specifics, but there remains a cloud over City Hall because everyone is like looking for clues and what's been said so far. Rumors are running rampant, and we're definitely not going to talk about those here, but I spent a lot of time on my phone fielding questions about rumors. But if we look back at what has been said publicly by federal authorities in press conferences, they have not ruled out. I can think of two instances where they've been asked recently, like, okay, is this it? Are we done? And the answer is not no. In one instance, the answer was, you know, there's, you know, two giant, you know, corruption task force ongoing. And the answer there from the FBI special agent in charge was, they're not going to be out of a job anytime soon. And then recently, Dave DeVillers, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District, who has been overseeing these investigations and this indictment, you know, he said on WLW earlier this week, when he was asked about it, he said, I can't. And he kind of took that as dot, 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 talk about it. And so that has left a lot of questions out there. And I have some myself.
Certainly. I think a lot of us have questions, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens, I suppose, as it relates to that. But we'll continue to watch. Meanwhile, as these corruption investigations go on, one member of council is currently suspended. That's Jeff Pastor. And there is a new face on council in the meantime. Who is it, Sherry?
This is Steve Gooden. He is a Republican. He's an attorney with the firm Graydon Law. And, you know, he's known around City Hall. This was a very interesting pick. It's not somebody who's run before, but somebody we heard was interested in running in the future. But he has done work with the city. He was part of the historic pension fix, and he represented employees there. So he knows all about that. He's represented the Economic Development Department and like going after companies that don't do what they promised to the city, like some outside counsel. And so he is the kind of person that's going to hit the ground running. And those are some of the things we know about him. But we have not had a meeting where we've gotten to know him yet. That's to come still.
I believe Chris Wetterick, the Business Courier reporter and columnist, is back with us, this time via old-fashioned mobile phone. Chris, are you there?
I am, Michael. Can you hear me?
I sure can. It's okay. We have all gotten used to like being delayed and how we're connecting with people. I think our listeners have been very kind to us as we all adapt to how we're connecting. So don't even worry about it. I don't know what you were able to hear there, Chris. We just talked about the new member of council replacing Jeff Pastor. We should note that two of the members arrested this year are Democrats. One is a Republican. But I am seeing some messages, Chris, from local Republican leaders after they've been all but completely routed out of countywide offices. Do they see an opening here to capitalize on the so-called culture of corruption at Cincinnati City Hall?
Yeah, they do. And Alex Triantafilou, the Hamilton County Republican chairman, has said as much. You know, I think the campaign where we see a lot of candidates run as reformers and the Republicans kind of foremost among them, I think they've also kind of tried behind the scenes to kind of minimize their association with Jeff Pastor. In the last year or so, it's been interesting to watch Jeff kind of evolve on his policy positions, not necessarily related to the charges against him, but on things like the streetcar and, you know, other issues, you know, he's kind of tried to walk in line there, you know, trying to develop some alliances with Democrats, but, you know, also kind of maintaining a, you know, stay out of my household kind of, you know, stance when it comes to the pandemic. He didn't like a mask mandate and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think they are trying, you know, going to try to distance themselves from him. But the fact of the matter is he was elected as a Republican and they enthusiastically supported him last time.
And so, Chris, what should we expect in terms of candidates lining up? We'll talk specifically about Kevin Flynn's candidacy, but as it relates to Republicans, are they working to recruit some candidates that maybe prior to these arrests they wouldn't have been doing so aggressively?
I think they're going to recruit aggressively. The names that we've seen so far are not names that are any surprise to us. We've seen Liz Keating, who's a marketing executive and a member of the, you know, the famous Keating family in the city of Cincinnati. She's, you know, got a very, very good ballot name, I would say, and kind of strikes a moderate image, a reasonable Republican, somebody who would work with Democrats who are, you know, going to probably end up being in the majority regardless of what the Republicans end up doing on council. There's a guy named Rashawn Mack who's got close ties to Vice Mayor Smitherman, very active on Twitter. He was rejected for a spot on the Southwest Ohio Regional Transit Authority board by this council a few years ago. He's definitely, I think, going to run. And you have some other names as well. But I think they're going to come up with a slate of people. It's, you know, going to be fairly robust.
As it relates to bipartisanship at City Hall, Sherry Coolidge, Mayor John Cranley, a Democrat, was congratulatory to this new Republican appointment to the council, right?
He was. And, you know, I think, you know, there's still definitely going to be some party politics. But at the same time, they worked on the pension deal together. I mean, they really know each other. Steve Gooden is very well respected. And that's what that congratulations was about, because they know each other and they slogged through that pension. It's still not great. It was a mess, and they slogged through it together in just a way that they came to a deal. And so I think that was really what those congratulations are about.
So go ahead, Sherry.
If you asked me 1 year ago from today, before Tamaya Dennard was arrested and Jeff Pastor and PG Sittenfeld, if any Republicans would be elected in 2021, I would say no. This county is so blue. This city is becoming more liberal. I do think that. And I think that that slate was really going to dominate. PG Sittenfeld was putting together a very, a slate that he was going to support. And I wondered if really for the first time we were going to see all Democrats. The Republicans, they see it. They're leaping on this. And with the whole cleanup corruption in City Hall. Steve Gooden is really, you know, Betsy Sunderman, you're going to see her come out of the gate when we start meeting again with, you know, charter amendments. She has some plans. She's going to be very vocal about this. She's going to have Steve Gooden as an ally of hers. And of course, the Democrats, we will definitely see some cleanup corruption things. But look for these Republicans to run these strong campaigns on, we're going to clean up City Hall.
Well, Councilman David Mann, Sherry, is running for mayor in 21. He's a Democrat, and he has been pretty vocal about seeking some methods to address what he has called a crisis at City Hall. Do you see this being able to support his candidacy as well, or will people consider this through a partisan lens only?
You know, it's hard to tell because there's so many, you know, ideas out there of what needs to clean up corruption, with the crux of all of it being, like, if people actually need to be ethical and know better. And of course, I will say that both Jeff and PG have said, you know, they're fighting these charges. PG has actually used the words himself, I'm innocent. So I want to put that out there. But with the idea of, well, if you were going to do this, like, no rule, no set of, you know, new measures would have changed the outcome of what happened, what we've heard. But everyone has these plans. I think at the end, we'll see some sort of mix of everybody's things kind of come forward.
We're talking with Sherry Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Chris Wetterich from the Cincinnati Business Courier. Chris, P.G. Sittenfeld, whom Sherry just referenced there, was the most recent council member arrested. I spoke this week with an NKU law professor who had written an op-ed with a similar theme for CityBeat that suggested the specific arrest of Sittenfeld was, in his view, prosecutorial overreach, that Sittenfeld will likely be able to beat the charges against him. We should note that Sittenfeld was a declared candidate for mayor, is a declared candidate for mayor. What does this do to those hopes of his politically, if his case, even if his case is indeed different?
I don't know. I don't know how he can run for mayor going forward. Look, I mean, if he is, you know, if he ran a campaign where the media didn't know where he was going to be, he's still going to be asked by voters, what's going on with this? They're going to want more details. So I think it's very difficult for him to run for mayor unless he were to somehow go to the judge, make a motion to have all of these charges thrown out and been successful. It's hard to see how that happens. The federal government does not file charges. It does not intend to vigorously prosecute. So I read the piece from the professor that you're talking about. I thought it was very interesting. I think that the case against him, just when you read the indictment, it's much different than what we see against Councilman Pastor and against what they had on Tamaya Denard. So I think it's going to be vigorously fought in court. But politically, it's hard to see Councilman Sittenfeld, you know, running for mayor and whatnot. You know, and we still don't have a result on whether he's going to be suspended from council. That whole process has to kind of work its way through.
You can listen to my interview with NKU law professor Ken Katkin at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab for more on that perspective about the uniqueness, he says, of the Sittenfeld charges. We should note that former city councilman Kevin Flynn is also leaping back into Cincinnati's political fray, as your headline, Chris, characterized it. What should we make of this, that even former people, former council people who maybe weren't planning to ever seek office again, are seeing this as an opportunity to return?
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Flynn, when we talked to him earlier this week, he said he didn't really want to do it, but now felt like he had a duty to do it, that he wanted to show people that there are people running for office in Cincinnati who want to do it, not because they want to climb a political ladder, but because they want to serve the city. And that's going to be the basis of his campaign. I asked him, it was funny, I asked him, I was like, well, what pushed you over the edge? The first, the second, or the third arrest? He said the second arrest made him bend and the third one made him break.
That's very interesting. And Sherry, there are already a few members on city council now because of these, either the arrest or a resignation, who were not elected. And we're seeing some pretty high profile names now, either announcing runs or exploring runs. Am I right in my assumption that next year's city council race is going to be a challenging one to handicap? There are a lot of talented people running, a lot of people with good names, or at least the abilities to build a name. I think that's going to be challenging to understand who might be front runners.
Well, it depends on who gets in the race, because people like Kevin Flynn, because they have name ID and what he's going to talk about, he's going to talk about a real record. I mean, there is, you know, people, he would be the low no vote on things in his 4-year term 3 years ago, because he wanted everything done by the charter. The charter was there for a reason, was always his thing. And, you know, he really was championing this charter review task force. Like, if you look back at that, which I have in, you know, recent weeks, they said, you know, they needed to look at what, you know, in the event that something happens and there needed to be more review and all of the things that came out of that charter review task force that he really wanted, they were killed for political reasons. Hardly anything came out of that. And so I think he does have a lot to talk about. He brought back the audit committee, like the kind of things the city is going to be looking for now, like were ideas that he was talking about and wants. And so if more people like him run with these name IDs, I'm not sure it's going to be that hard to handicap, But guessing who might get in at this point is definitely everyone's favorite parlor game, should everyone have a chance to be together, which it's all over the phone.
And Chris Wedderk, I know you're a stealth player at that parlor game. So what do you think of the challenge of figuring out who's got a real shot next year?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a very large field. I'm just going to completely dodge your question, Michael. I have no idea. I mean, pass rule, you know, we saw, with the exception of the 2011 council election, that incumbency is a very, very potent force. And I still think, to a degree, that is going to be true, even though we're going to have one true incumbent running, Greg Landsman. I don't think there's any doubt that if he runs for reelection, that he will get back on there. I would disagree with something Sherry said earlier about there before these arrests being no Republicans on council. I thought the councilman Pastor was positioning himself in an interesting way, and I thought that he would probably prevail and reclaim his seat, even if he finished ninth. But you know, obviously that's not going to happen now. I think we just need to see the whole field. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this election is going to be, how are these folks going to raise money in this environment? You know, who's going to write checks to them when we've had three people arrested with perhaps more to come? I think that's a really interesting question, and whether big donors in this city are going to be wary of giving much money to these politicians. And if that's the case, if they won't be able to get on TV with TV ads, how are they going to get their names out? They're going to have to really walk precincts and do the ground game that some people kind of avoid by spending big money on TV. So I think that's an X factor here.
That's a very good point, and we'll have a lot to talk about in the coming months, and I hope you all will be willing to join us again to do just that. Sherry Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Chris Wedderk from the Cincinnati Business Courier, it's always a pleasure to talk to each of you, especially together. Thanks for taking some time on Friday with us.
Thanks,
Rob. Jay Hanselman. Thanks.
We miss Jay Hanselman, too. And just ahead, a two-year examination of the effort to arm teachers here in Ohio. We explore a new podcast from Vice News. And later, why a producer of The Simpsons decided to send two characters to Cincinnati last Sunday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Two parts of a new three-part investigative podcast from Vice News explores what it means to be safe in school, including the culture around arming teachers in Ohio. Joining us now is Vice News reporter and producer Jen Kenney. Jen, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
This was such an intriguing, engaging podcast in three parts. We've got a link at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab for people who might have difficulty finding it. If they just Google it, I'm sure it will come up. It's definitely worth listening to and involves certainly a local case. People remember back in 2016 when a 14-year-old student shot two other students in Madison Township at a school there in Butler County. What brought you to Ohio to study this state specifically, Jen?
Yeah, so I, like a lot of people, didn't think about arming teachers or know about this as an idea until President Trump raised it in 2018 as a possibility after Parkland. And not long after that, I was a local reporter here in Pennsylvania where I live, and I was sent to cover a school board meeting where a school was considering arming their teachers. And I was just pretty taken aback that they were really seriously considering going down this road and drafting policy. And I started looking into it and realized that a number of states had been arming their teachers for years, and Ohio was one of them. And since it was right next door to Pennsylvania, I started making trips and talking to people to find out what that looked like.
Well, tell our audience what you found as it relates to people's feelings on the subject. Did you even find different perspectives within the education community?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I mean, I found there were some teachers who were ready and willing and wanted to be allowed to carry guns in their schools, had even gone and petitioned their districts to allow it. And then others who felt really alarmed by the idea. I spoke to a teacher who wasn't the only reason, but, you know, she left a school that she was working at because they decided to arm staff.
So it's just all over the place with people being willing or hesitant. You did speak with one superintendent of Madison schools. Of course, he's no longer the superintendent there. He left a little while ago. His name is Chris Philpott. You interviewed him as part of this series. Josh, let's hear from that superintendent.
The decision was already made. They already had their votes. They weren't interested in anything that anybody had to say.
The superintendent, Curtis Philpott, he'd lived through the shooting and he'd been at the school for 16 years. And he did not agree with arming teachers.
Every teacher in that building would need a gun. And how do you train that person? Then they're not really a teacher anymore. Now they're a police officer, which we had too. So I didn't feel like it was necessary. I saw more bad coming out of it than good.
So he resigns.
I was going to be the face of that policy.
He said it wasn't the only reason, but
I was going to be the one that was going to have to explain it, to go out in front and share it and sell it, explain it to teachers, the kids, the families. I don't know that I'm that good of a liar that I could sell something that I didn't believe in.
I mean, that's an intense reaction to this policy, Jen. And I mean, for someone to have that long of a career within that school district and then to decide that this is the policy that would break his back and he couldn't go forward with it. Talk about the conversations you had with him.
Yeah, well, so actually the first person we heard in that clip was a parent.
I apologize for not setting that up very well.
Oh, no, that's fine. And, you know, I think he had a similar reaction, Curtis, the former superintendent, which was that, you know, he didn't feel that he had a lot of control over this. The school board in Madison was making this decision. And even though he was going to have to be the one who would implement it and kind of argue for it to his parents and students and teachers, he wasn't really being asked how he felt about it. And he says elsewhere in the podcast, you know, he was concerned that this was going to turn teachers into police officers. And he didn't see why we should do that.
But as we noted moments ago, some people in the education community are in favor of moving forward with this type of policy. We've got a piece of the podcast documentary that you put together, Jen, that involves a conversation with Angie, an elementary school teacher here.
Our district has armed staff to protect our students, and I was asked to join the program, so I agreed. I volunteered. So.
There's around 40 to 50 total staff in Angie's school. And 15 of them are already armed.
I know when it was talked about, there was a lot of controversy. Oh, gun school, you know, it could go off. There could be accidents. I was instantly like, yes, I was all for it. So
the armed teachers' identities are supposed to be confidential. But Angie says that after school, the armed staff go to firing ranges together to train, sort of like a club.
And if people ask where you're going, you have to just think of something quick. Oh, you have a meeting. Where? Off campus. You know, you just have to get out of there. So, but it's for everybody's own good.
You're listening to pieces of a new podcast series from Vice News. It's called Armed. It's a three-part series that explores the response in the education community to gun violence within that community. And we're joined by the producer of the segments, Jen Kenny of Vice News. Jen, I think culturally we have a general generic idea of a teacher in our mind, and maybe outside of rare exceptions, it doesn't involve like a holster or a gun on their person. Tell us about your conversations with Angie.
Well, I think my conversations with Angie really speak to the extraordinary nature of American education in the sense that we are the only country that experiences regular attacks of the kind that arming teachers is supposed to counter. And so when I spoke to Angie, you know, in a lot of ways, she is your platonic ideal of a great teacher. She loves her students. She talks about that all the time. She's always talking about decorating her classroom. And, you know, she's a dedicated teacher. And as she's seeing all this news about school shootings and that we've failed to come up on a national level with some policy that seems to stop or slow or reduce the number that we have, she's decided this is the best way to keep her students safe. And so I think for her, it's really in line with everything else she does for her students, whether that's, you know, talking to them after school or being there for them emotionally. She's come to see carrying a gun as an extension of that.
And of course, we're talking about educators. These are people who are highly educated. They probably have graduate level degrees by certain points in their careers, but they have to be trained again because perhaps they're not individuals who know about guns in a personal way. And so you also talk to someone who leads such trainings. Let's hear a clip from that.
Of course, I can be abrasive and I say things that may only be funny to me. But the job you've kind of volunteered for is not clean and neat, and it's not PC. Because we're talking about potentially shooting young people. Might not be young person, might be a parent that comes in, but we're talking about shooting not only young people, not only women or elderly people. We're talking about killing another human being, which is not normal for us. It's not built into our DNA. It's not something that's natural. If you're not just a little bit sick and twisted, this is probably not the job for you. We have to be violent. We have to be prepared to commit violence. Most of you guys, some people have heard it, is be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everyone you meet.
Jen, so much of those comments from Chris Serino, the trainer, are just shocking because you think of him talking to teachers in that manner of, you know, be prepared to kill everyone you meet. Was this surprising to you as you watched this?
Yeah, it definitely was. This was part of a 3-day training that I went to. It's where I met Angie, the teacher we heard in the last clip. And, you know, she had only touched a gun really for the first time about a month earlier. And so this training was going to be the main education she had in using a gun and how to carry it in her school and how to think about her role as an armed staff member. And this was the kind of message she was getting. The training is run by the Buckeye Firearms Association, which is a major pro-gun lobbying group in Ohio. And their trainers largely are police trainers. So they're, you know, Ohio police officers. And a lot of the messaging that they were giving to these teachers and the education they were getting on what this role meant and what it would require of them, it really centered around a willingness to use violence and almost a fear-based approach to how these teachers should think about their role in the school.
You spent some time in this series, Jen, talking with Cooper Caffrey, who is one of the two students shot in Madison. We're talking about fear right now. I mean, how is Cooper after 4 years later?
You know, Cooper, and you hear this in the podcast, he and his dad, they're really close and they've really helped each other through this. And they use a lot of humor to get through it together. And you really hear that in the show. But they definitely also make the case for not succumbing to fear as a response to such a traumatic event. You know, Cooper was out in front of trying to say that he didn't want his school to arm teachers. He didn't feel afraid in the way that I think these policies suggest everyone should feel afraid. And he didn't think his school should have gone down this path.
What surprised you as you were gathering this, all of this material, talking to all of these people? Did anything surprise you from the time you started to when you finally put it all together?
Yeah, I think the first surprise, which I think a lot of people will have upon hearing this series, although maybe not in Ohio, where there's been this high profile case for the past few years, is just how common this has become. I think a lot of people, when I speak to them about this series and when I began it, didn't realize that so many places had already begun to arm teachers. But the second thing in trying to figure out exactly how many there were was realizing how hard that is to figure out and how many states and schools have no obligation to tell the public that they're going to arm some of their staff members. And there were even cases I found where schools or individuals were finding kind of these loopholes where maybe their state didn't really allow armed staff, but they could figure out a way to do it anyway. Or their school district technically said that they weren't going to do this, but people were bringing their guns anyway. That came up multiple times in my reporting.
You can find the 3-part series Armed from Vice News Reports on Apple Podcasts. We'll have a link at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. Part one, titled Soft Targets, is where you'll see the profile or listen to the profile of Cooper Caffrey, the young student who was shot in Madison. And the second part is called The Good Guys, and that's where you get to know more about Angie, the teacher who is learning how to arm herself. Part three, one we haven't discussed, is called The Guardians. What can we expect from that third installment, Jen?
So that episode is really about how after the shooting at Parkland in 2018, the state of Florida adopted guns in schools as a statewide policy to combat school shootings, and how for a lot of schools, one of the most affordable ways to do that has been to arm some of their teachers and staff.
We'll be sure to listen to that one again for me, but highly recommend, very good listening. Jen Kenney, thank you so much for alerting us to this and taking some time to talk more about it. We'll look forward to chatting with you again sometime.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, David Pepper, a well-known local politician, is stepping down at the end of the year. Let's talk about why and what that means. Joining us is WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. He's on Zoom. Hey, Howard.
Good morning.
So what are the circumstances when a party chairman decides to step down? Is it usually after an unsuccessful election cycle?
Well, yes, it is, particularly several unsuccessful election cycles. They're kind of like baseball managers. You know, they're hired to be fired. Although, you know, David Pepper was not fired, but he got the message that there were a lot of people in the party said, hey, look, we need to go in a different direction. We're not making any progress here. They're 0-15 in the last elections for statewide offices, the statewide constitutional offices, that is. They did pick up a Supreme Court seat this year. But, you know, generally speaking, it's not been very good.
In fact, you wrote in, or we should note that David Pepper took over the Ohio Democratic Party back in 2015, and this was after another unsuccessful election cycle, which you just sort of referenced there.
That's right.
They lost every statewide race 6 years ago, back in 2014, including one that David Pepper himself competed in. It was the race for attorney general. Pepper was the Democratic nominee, and he was up against Republican Mike DeWine, who is now the governor. And according to some reporting, to remind us, former chairman of the party, Chris Redfern, resigned that position after losing his own race for the state house. So we're talking about the better part of the past decade being challenging for Democrats. And this was after Barack Obama had some success here as a Democratic presidential candidate in 08 and 12. And what happened in this state that's trending it so favorably for Republicans?
Well, one of the things that happened is Donald Trump. You know, of course, in 2016, he came along. He took a whole lot of very traditional Democratic voters, mostly blue-collar workers, people in northeast Ohio, people in eastern Ohio, even up in the Toledo area. And he switched them, you know, from blue to red. And I think that was one of the biggest things. That had a ripple effect down the line in lower ticket races. And it just snowballed. And there was no way that Pepper or anybody else could stop it.
We should note that Democrats in Kentucky are facing a similar and maybe even a starker set of circumstances. Their Democratic Party chairman has stepped down. A new one is already in place after a disastrous election cycle for Democrats in Kentucky. What type of influence does a party chairman wage when taking over with such an uphill climb ahead?
Well, in the Democratic Party, it's particularly difficult because you have so many constituency groups, you have so many competing interests inside the party itself, that you have to keep everybody together and on the same page and working towards a common goal. It is not easy. It's herding cats. And it's, you know, in some ways, it's almost impossible. But David Pepper, to his credit, he was able to build some organization in some smaller cities in Ohio, and had some very good success in getting Democrats elected in some of those smaller towns where Democrats hadn't been elected for decades. And they're still there. So they're kind of the seed for the future for the Democratic Party. That's what they hope anyway. But it's going to take a while.
Howard, I know you're paying attention to what appears to be schisms in both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing ahead of the Georgia runoff elections for the two U.S. Senate seats there, some farther right conservatives trying to influence people, maybe not to even vote if the election isn't turned in favor of Donald Trump. And so that's pitting some far right conservatives against more mainstream or Trump conservatives, even in the Republican Party. We're seeing Barack Obama himself facing some serious criticism after his own criticism of the term defund the police from members of the farther left portion of the Democratic Party. Do we see any type of schism like that playing out in the Ohio Democratic Party as it seeks out its next chief?
Well, I think you will. It's going to be a pretty interesting battle that goes on, you know, the establishment type politicians versus the progressives, the Bernie Sanders people. You know, there'll be a fight. And on the Republican side, I think it's even more interesting, really, because they you're looking at a situation where in 2022, Mike DeWine, the governor, could well have a primary opponent from the Trump side of the party. And, you know, they're split. And the issue that's been splitting them is Mike DeWine's response to COVID-19, which a lot of Republicans in Ohio think has been too extreme and too dictatorial. And even Rob Portman could face a challenge from a Trump loyalist type.
Well, you're raising a couple of interesting points there, because while there aren't significant statewide partisan races in 21, there are in 22. And like said, you've got the Ohio governorship that will be up for grabs if Mike DeWine's running for re-election. And then you have Senator Portman's seat also on the ballot, so they could face primary challenges, which could be a good opportunity for strong Democratic candidates. So that's probably among the first orders of business, wouldn't it be, for the new chairman to start to lay the groundwork for whoever those candidates might be?
Yes, I think that'll be job number one. They also need to work on, you know, some of the other state constitutional offices, you know, and start picking one or two of them off at a time, because that's where you build a farm team for gubernatorial candidates in the future. I mean, that's just the way it works in Ohio. You get elected to one of the lower offices and you kind of move your way up.
Howard, at WVXU.org, your new column this week offers analysis on whether Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat from Northeastern Ohio, will challenge Rob Portman in 2022. And you conclude in the headline anyway, maybe. What are the chances?
I think it's a possibility. I think the as the column said, that there are people that believe that when the census numbers are in, Ohio is going to lose a congressional seat. It could be. Tim Ryan's seat up in Northeast Ohio, and that he could get thrown into a new district that's dominated by Republicans, and he will at long last, after many years of thinking about running for statewide office, he may be forced into it if he wants to stay in public service. That may be his only choice, is to run for the Senate against Rob Portman.
As to David Pepper, the Democratic chairman who is stepping down at the end of this year, he's not been greatly successful in his own campaigns. He was elected to Cincinnati City Council and was elected to the Hamilton County Commission, but he lost races for mayor back in 2005. He lost statewide races for auditor and attorney general in 2010 and 2014, respectively. Mm-hmm. Is his political career over? I know he's also an author. What do you think's next for him?
I don't know. I'm not sure his political career is over. He had a record of actually learning from his mistakes in political campaigns, like when in 2005 when he ran for mayor against Mark Mallory. Mark Mallory had a very simple message: end the chaos at City Hall. David Pepper had this much more complicated message with 100-page mission statements and all this sort of thing that nobody ever read and nobody paid any attention to. And he learned from that and came back a couple of years later and won a seat on the Hamilton County Commission, beat an incumbent Republican. So, you know, he learns his lesson. Now, he has other things to do. He's writing books. He's actually a very good painter, too. He's been painting a lot. And he's got small children at home, you know, which he would like to spend more time with.
You just said that Mark Mallory had a successful mayoral campaign back in 2005 with the simple message of end the chaos at City Hall.
Yes.
Wonder if that message might return to the vernacular locally in next year's mayoral election.
Oh, I think so. And it actually even might be, you know, it's possible that it could be Mark Mallory delivering the message. I talked to him the other day. He wouldn't, you know, he was pretty coy about it. He wouldn't say that he's going to run, but he did say that a lot of people have been urging him to. If he did, he could revive that theme very easily this year. And, you know, maybe ride it all the way to the mayor's office again.
So we may see the return of Mark Mallory.
It's possible.
WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend, Howard.
Okay, you too, Michael. Thanks.
And Cincinnati lit up the small screen on Sunday in high-definition animation. The Simpsons sent two characters to town, and social media posts showed high approvals for the city's portrayal. Let's hear a little bit.
Oh, did you know that in Cincinnati they have four different ways of preparing chili?
You don't say, huh?
The two-way, chili with spaghetti.
How about
the three-way, chili with spaghetti and cheese.
Please shut up.
And there's two kinds of four-ways.
I want to die.
So that's Principal Skinner and Superintendent Chalmers, or as Ralph Wiggum calls him, Super Nintendo Chalmers, on their way to Cincinnati for an education conference at the Duke Energy Center. Throughout the episode, you can see the skyline, and you can see a skyline chili in Clifton that was wildly popular on social media. Let's talk about how this came to be. WVXU media beat writer John Keyswetter is on Zoom with us. Hey, Keys.
Hey, man, how you doing?
I'm doing well. This was so exciting, and man, did it delight local viewers, because Twitter really lit up after this premiered, and boy, the city looked great.
I thought the riverfront view with the suspension bridge, the barges, the BB riverboat, the Reds ballpark, and the P&G towers and everything, that was just spectacular, and it was very accurate in a Simpsons style. I mean, that should be a T-shirt.
Oh, totally. I mean, I would want a print of this on my wall. It's so beautiful. But I think the most memorable shot for people is that of Superintendent Chalmers and Principal Skinner eating at the Skyline Chili location on Ludlow Avenue in Clifton. That looked really, really cool.
You know, of all the ones they could pick, and I had the good fortune to talk to Matt Selman, the showrunner, the executive producer, and he said that actually it was one of the animators that picked that. Well, you think that, you know, other than the Price Hill location, that's probably the most iconic skyline around. The camera backed out of the window, and you could see the gaslight lamps and the red brick buildings on the street. It was really just wonderful.
So you got to speak with this producer. Did you get any insight about why Cincinnati became the target?
Well, he wanted to the start of this. He wanted to do a road trip with Selman and with Chalmers and Skinner, just kind of a bonding, you know, love hate trip. And they were going to go to a convention. He thought Cincinnati's a great city. It's a nice convention place that we do a lot of conventions here. And also, in case you didn't notice, Selman is a huge chili fan. I mean, he was hungry as we talked and kept on talking about he needed to go get a chili dog. And then he asked me how I liked Skyline. It was clear that when he comes here, he'll get a cheese cone. But I said, no, I get a four-way. And he goes, oh, that's interesting. He's a chili fan. And so he wanted to marry up those two, and that's why he picked Cincinnati. And as I was speaking to him, he was, because these episodes, because the Korean animators finish them, and because it's an international production, they're done so far in advance. But he was screening it on his computer as we talked, and he realized how big the bowls were, and they knew that this was a mistake after the animation was done, and it was just too expensive to fix it. And he was just obsessed with the fact that they showed them eating spaghetti out of bowls, chili spaghetti, instead of plates.
Well, that they couldn't get it all correct, I suppose. So that was an interesting take. So you talked to him about Springfield, right? The Simpsons live in Springfield in sort of a no-named state, and it's been a long-running gag to figure out which Springfield they live in because there are Springfields all over. You asked Matt Selman, the producer, saying that you always thought the Simpsons lived in Springfield, Illinois, probably the most commonly known one. You found out from some readers of your blog here at WVXU.org that Springfield, Massachusetts is 803 miles from Cincinnati. That's significant because in this episode, there's a sign that says they're driving about that distance to Cincinnati. What did Selman have to say?
Well, when I pointed that out, the first story that I put up Monday, right after the Sunday episode, with some pictures from it, several people pointed out instantly that Springfield, Massachusetts was 803 miles away. And he goes, no, that wasn't our tent. He said, we always try to baffle and frustrate people because in his mind, Springfield is everywhere. Springfield is a place in America that's got it's near the Grand Canyon, but it's near the ocean. It's got an upper peninsula. It's even near the salt flats. And so in his mind, Springfield is everywhere in the United States and nowhere.
Well, I had a bone to pick with this as well, because I used to be a huge Simpsons fan back in the day. And in the 2000 episode, Beyond the Laughter, and this was sort of a Simpsons version of Behind the Music that VH1 was doing at that time, exploring musical acts, they flat out said in this documentary style episode that the Simpsons live, and get this, Northern Kentucky. That's not a joke. I freaked out watching this. It was on Channel 19, of course, the Fox station here. And I thought maybe they did special locations for all of the affiliates. But no, you can still watch this episode. And they say this Northern Kentucky family. So in a way, John Keysweater Sunday Night's episode broke my heart because I thought I always lived where the Simpsons did.
Well, the magic of The Simpsons is because it's animation. You know, there's so many shows that had young kids in it that got older each year. They had a change, and they had then add a younger kid because the kids got older. The magic of this show in 32 years is that Bart's still in the fourth grade, and yes, there is an institutional history to it all, but there's also they can go anywhere and do anything. And this one was fun for me, because it really was a marriage of my two favorite shows, The Simpsons and WKRP.
Oh, yeah, because they conclude the episode with the WKRP theme, which was really cool to bring that all together.
And when Chalmers and Skinner are having their Skyline chili spaghetti, they actually played the line from the opening lyrics, you know, maybe you and me were never meant to be, but maybe you'll think of me once in a while. It's kind of their bonding scene. And I just thought it was really cool.
It was very cool. And to think that Bart Simpson, you know, we are technically the same age. I mean, the show came on in 1989. He's 9 years old. I was 9 years old in 1989. I'm telling you, I can't jump on a skateboard the way he still can, so I guess I'm envious of that. John Keysweater, maybe you'll think of me once in a while and come back on the show and talk to us more about the media. Always great to chat. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for thinking of me.
Absolutely. And you can read John Keysweater's Media Beat blog and all of this Simpsons coverage, and it's blowing up. Matt Groening, the creator of the show, retweeted one of his articles. So go to WVXU.org and check that out. And thanks for spending part of your Friday with Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. More of our episodes online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.